Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some important conversations lined up for you. In a moment, I'll talk to the executive director of a community health center about the important work those centers do all across the country, offering healthcare access to so many Americans who would otherwise be without it. Then I'll talk to former White House chef and decorated combat veteran Andre Rush about his service to our country and his work serving meals to four U.S. presidents. Right now, to get things started, I'm joined by Dr. Bassem Khan, Executive Director of Neighborhood Health in Alexandria, Virginia. Dr. Khan, thanks so much for coming on the show. And tell us a little bit about community health centers and the role these centers play in expanding access to quality health care across the country.
Well, first of all, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And that is correct. I'm a physician, a primary care physician, and executive director at a community health center called Neighborhood Health in Alexandria, Virginia. So community health centers have been around for many years. They started back in the 60s when the first two community health centers were set up during President Johnson's war on poverty. There was a need for healthcare for people who otherwise did not have access to such healthcare. And the community health center program started with two initial community health centers. Currently, there are 1,400 community health centers across the country. Organizations like ours, nonprofit organizations that provide primary care to a largely low-income, uninsured or underinsured patient population, serving about 30 million Americans across the country. Again, people who don't have health insurance or a lot of people who have Medicaid. And the services we provide are primary medical care, so you know, adult medicine, internal medicine, family medicine, pediatrics as well, women's health, and then basic labs and vaccines, assistance, signing up for different services like health insurance and case management, access to low-cost medication. So a lot of these community health centers across the country provide what we call a primary care medical home, a place where people who otherwise would not have access to healthcare are able to see a doctor, get medication, get labs, and just, you know, people who can help guide them through the medical system. So, you know, it's been a very important part of the safety net across, you know, communities across the country.
And how does this work for organizations when you're caring for people who perhaps can't afford major medical bills or, like you mentioned, don't have health insurance? How does that work?
So, you know, we get funding from different sources to be able to provide this care. And what we end up doing is if a patient comes to us and they get referred from all sorts of places, the emergency rooms or hospitals or out in the community, a lot of times it's word of mouth. And if they have Medicaid or any other form of health insurance, we'll see them like any other doctor's office. So it really isn't that much different there in that respect. But then if they don't have health insurance, what we do is ask for any backup information to show their income and household size. And those are the only two things we look at. And just to, you know, be sure that they're low income. And what we end up seeing, are patients who make less than 200% of the federal poverty level. So, you know, really like, you know, $50,000 for a family of three. And we put them on a sliding fee scale, which means, you know, a much lower cost that they would have to pay. And then we provide them primary care like any other doctor's office. So at that point, you know, once they're in the system, if you will, it's no different than if they were going to see their regular primary care doctor. And, you know, many of our patients, I've been seeing patients here for 10 years, have stayed with us for years. And even after they get in health insurance, because, you know, the quality of care is good, and it's, again, no different than any other doctor's office. I mean, you can end up staying with us. One advantage in that respect is if people lose their insurance, they can still see the doctor. If they get health insurance, again, they can still see the doctor. So you have continuity. And that's really important in this day and age. You want patients to, have relationships with people that they trust. And, you know, that really helps with that, because regardless of whether or not they have health insurance, we're going to see them.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Dr. Bassem Khan, Executive Director of Neighborhood Health in Alexandria, Virginia. And these community health centers, a lot of times we'll find people who don't have health insurance. They'll go to, say, an emergency room for something that maybe a primary care doctor would normally deal with. Is part of the mission of many of these community health centers to raise awareness of their existence within the community to bring those patients into the center as opposed to going to an emergency room?
That's exactly right. They're, you know, in areas where there are community health centers, that's a place where a patient can access care instead of going to the emergency room. And what we've seen time and time again is in areas where you don't have good access to basic primary care, people, as you can imagine, they end up going to the emergency room for things that they wouldn't otherwise have needed to go to the emergency room for. And that causes all sorts of problems. First of all, it's just not a good experience for the patient, right? Having to wait really long times. And sometimes they get stuck with bills, even when there are charity policies in place for them in the emergency room. And, you know, and emergency rooms really should be meant for emergencies. But the way you achieve that is by ensuring that people have good access to primary care. And it's not only the existence of a community health center, but it's also, you know, are you open on evenings? Are you open on weekends?
Sure.
Are the fees affordable? Do you have people who speak your language? I think that's another advantage of community health centers, is that a lot of, you know, staff tend to speak the languages of the communities their patients come from, and a lot of times they come from the same communities. So there's an orientation towards the populations that we're meant to serve. And all of these, you know, things that we do, the point is to make it a place that's inviting and that's able to provide services where patients choose to come in here so they don't go to the emergency room or, you know, get care in a way that's not, you know, that's not optimal. Or even worse, you know, sometimes we see people who go without care altogether, because you see them on the other end, right? If they have had a heart attack or had a stroke, and, you know, then they get referred to us, and you talk to them and they said, listen, I didn't have health insurance. I didn't know that there were options. And, you know, that's why they went without medicine for all these years.
And on that note, how much of what you do is preventing even worse outcomes from presenting themselves? People are able to go to these community health centers and kind of get ahead of the problem rather than it becoming something much worse than maybe what it originally was if they had just gone to see a doctor immediately.
I think that's so much of what primary care is about in the first place. You know, a lot of times I get asked by people, I'm, you know, young and I'm healthy, you know, I don't really need a primary care doctor. But the reality is, you know, being plugged into primary care helps prevent problems down the road. You know, you can do screenings for different types of cancers, which obviously is important. You can screen for cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure. And then the other important part is you establish a relationship with a clinician. And so that when you are sick and you're scared, that you're not on your own. You're not seeing people for the first time. Instead, you're talking to someone who knows you, who can help guide you through a process. And ultimately, that relationship is something that's really important in helping people over time, that trust, if you will. And that's where I think primary care in general, but also community health centers, more specifically for populations who don't have health insurance or low income or face other barriers to care, that's why it's just so critically important.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined right now by Dr. Bassem Khan, Executive Director of Neighborhood Health in Alexandria, Virginia. What role have community health centers like yours played in the COVID-19 response, including vaccinations?
Community health centers have played a significant role in the COVID-19 response. And one way to understand this is that the patients that we serve are those who in many ways have been most impacted by the pandemic. People who, you know, are at a higher risk because they live in crowded housing conditions. People who have to take public transport to work because they can't afford a car and they certainly can't work from home. People who sometimes don't get paid sick leave because that's not available to them in the place that they work. Those are the patients that we serve. And one thing that we noticed early on in the pandemic was that our patients were testing positive at rates that were much higher than the regional averages. So our patients are the ones, if you will, being impacted the most. And because of that, community health centers have played a significant role in the response through testing, through vaccinations, you know, through other initiatives, so to reach the most underserved communities. And what's good is that the federal government has recognized this role that community health centers played. And because of that, they've provided community health centers with tools to reach these populations, to ensure that testing isn't only available, you know, for people with insurance, for example, or in people in more affluent communities, but instead that it's also available in low-income communities. And especially that's been the case with vaccinations as well. Community health centers have played a large role in the vaccine rollout, and they've played a large role in reaching, you know, communities that had otherwise would have been more difficult to reach. You know, people of color, people who are low income, community health centers have really played a large role in just getting out there and into the communities where these services are needed most.
And how much has trust played a role in getting people to come to these community health centers when they may be infected with COVID-19, and to also get them vaccinated because they're going to a place where they're likely familiar with the physicians and trust their advice?
You know, I can't tell you how many times when I've been talking to patients, they've been on the fence about vaccination because, you know, they've been exposed to some information that raises doubts, but they say, you know, doctor, because I trust you, and I've been seeing you for so many years. If you think this is the right thing for me, I'm going to do it. That's a very common occurrence in community health centers across the country, because you know they trust their clinicians who've known them for years, but they also trust community health centers in general to some degree because that's where people from their community get all types of care, and thus COVID testing or vaccinations or treatment now is no different as well. Trust has been a really big piece in the puzzle when it's come to being, you know, able to get this, you know, information and get vaccination out into the communities. But the other piece of that puzzle has been that of access. One thing that community health centers have done well is really ensured that vaccines are easily available for, you know, those communities. And one thing that we've done, for example, is we've gone out into the community itself, so not just at our clinics, but also, you know, working with, for example, low-income housing to make sure vaccines are available right there where people live. So, you know, if they have jobs where they come home late, or we want to make it as easy as possible, we've gone into churches. We've gone into community centers. We've gone into sort of shopping areas and the community fairs. Try to reach out into the community so that you make it as easy as possible for people to get vaccinated. So along with trust, access has been really important in really ensuring that we're able to reach as many people as possible in more vulnerable communities.
In terms of people being hesitant about taking the COVID-19 vaccines, what are some of the responses that you've heard in your community health center?
You know, we've heard everything. You know, a lot of it you've seen in the media as well. We've heard a lot of people thinking that, you know, they're not vulnerable to the vaccine. So, I mean, they're not vulnerable to the virus. So, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy. I think I'll be fine. That's one thing that we've heard of a lot. You hear other conspiracies about how the vaccine can have all sorts of side effects, or how it was rushed to the market is something that people talk about, even though that's not the case in the sense that it did undergo the full trials. So we've heard all of this, and one concern we do have is the amount of misinformation that's out there. But ultimately it goes back to, you know, leaning on people who trusted figures, if you will, to try to get the word out there. And that includes a lot of community partners that we've in turn worked with you know, whether it's faith leaders, whether it's other nonprofits, people who have relationships in the community, and then ourselves as primary care providers as well to be able to counter this information. I think one thing I also would like to say here is that, you know, you have to meet people where they are and do it in a way that is respectful, that's not condescending, you know, for people, you know, you still leave open the door. And I've had many instances where people, you know, they weren't comfortable getting a vaccine at a certain point in time, but that doesn't mean that at a later point in time, that they wouldn't consider it. And, you know, you just leave open the door to continue those conversations. You know, I'm happy when I see a lot of our efforts. You know, this weekend, for example, we had, you know, outreach events with vaccination, and, you know, a lot of people we vaccinated were for the first time, the primary series, you know, they finally decided to go ahead and get the vaccine. And you just want to make sure you're accessible, that you leave the door open so that even if people have waited this long, you know, you're there for them when they finally do decide to get the vaccine.
Dr. Bassem Khan, Executive Director of Neighborhood Health in Alexandria, Virginia, with an update on community health centers across the country and the work they're doing to support the COVID-19 response and vaccination efforts. Dr. Khan, we really appreciate the work you're doing on the ground there in Northern Virginia, and also for coming on the show and breaking all of that down for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm Ryan Gorman here on iHeartRadio Communities, and joining me now, a guest I'm very excited to talk to, former White House chef and decorated combat veteran Andre Rush, who has a new memoir out titled Call Me Chef, Damn It, A Veteran's Journey from the Rural South to the White House. Chef Rush, thanks so much for coming on the show, and of course, thank you so much for your service to this country. And let's start there. How did you first end up joining the military?
So the military wasn't even so when I was a younger kid. I'm from Mississippi, small town, nine kids. It was nine of us. And my sister's a colonel in the Air Force. My brother was a colonel in the Navy. My other sister, Merchant Marine. Just a family of servitude. And I was much younger. So what happened was, without me even knowing it, it was what I was meant to do. I had scholarships scholarships for football, track, and art, and I decided to join the military instead without telling anyone. And that was my whole thing, was just doing something on my own because I wanted to give back and I wanted to serve my country. I literally wanted to serve my country. And it just took me on a whirlwind of just emotions and leading me down different directions and paths of failure and success.
Did you begin your career as a chef while in the military?
I did, actually. When I got to the military, I had the opportunity to switch over some stuff. And just because I love cooking, well, I didn't even know it was culinary at the time. I love cooking with my mom because of how it made me feel. And then when I actually did that, the military was very different. It was mass feeding, and it wasn't what I thought it would be. And it was always disrespected back then. Back then, cooking wasn't as popular. It's not as popular as it is now, especially for black males or men or anybody in general. And someone saw me one day doing something, and they said, I want to take you to a culinary show. I was like, you know, what's that? And they took me there. I was the opportunity to be younger. And when they did it, it opened my eyes to so many different other possibilities and opportunities of becoming a master pastry chef, a master ice carver, chocolatiers. And I went to the Olympics and competed all over the world and just competition, and love of cooking and love of food. And that's what kind of got me my start. And it was just an amazing journey.
So how do you eventually wind up at the White House, where you served under four U.S. presidents, President Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and then most recently Donald Trump?
So that was never supposed to happen. I mean, the White House wasn't even my radar. It was never even a thought. I didn't even think you could possibly even get there. Like I said, I was from Mississippi. I was just a guy who loved to cook, you know, who later became a chef, who just said the title. And when I went to the Pentagon, I had an opportunity to work there. And when I got there and tried out for the job, one of the guys didn't want me to come. And I found out, but the Navy, actually, I'm in the Army, a Navy guy actually wanted me to come. And he was in charge. And he told him to get me there. I went there, worked my butt off. And one day, the guy that didn't want me to come failed on a tasking for a very important event. I saved him. And he was the one who actually got me to the door there. Because the truth of the matter is that it could have never happened. Even with my clearances and all those things, it's always about somebody that you know to make life easier for you. But the Pentagon, I mean, the White House is not in Craigslist or in, you know, looking at the ads or anything like that. It's about a tight circle of people and people you trust and can know that you don't have to watch your back, you know, over. So that's literally how it happened.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by former White House chef Andre Rush, who has a new memoir out, Call Me Chef, Damn It, A Veteran's Journey from the Rural South to the White House. Speaking of your time at the Pentagon, you were working there on September 11, 2001. Tell us about your experience on that tragic day.
That was a day that changed the world. That was a day that I lost some great friends, dear friends. That was a day that I lost myself. That was a day that I discovered that at the time I didn't discover that I had PTSD, that I have PTSD. And that was a time that that kind of led me up to who I am and what I am now, of doing the things that I do and why I do them. It was the day that we realized that people attacked us in our own backyard, in our own homes, in our own comfort, our own jobs, with our family, with our kids, with each other. That was a time when I realized that was the first that the whole entire world kind of came as one. And that was a time that there wasn't any racial divide, no statue quo, no arrogance or ego. There was just only support and trying to do what we needed to do for each other. So, and it was also a time of hurt and forgiving, and a time of learning and healing. And I said just 2 weeks ago, one of the guys that I was there with called me up, and I hadn't talked to him in over 10 years, and he was a DOD cop. And he told me, Chef, you know, I need help, you know, from 9/11 and my wife, I'm attacking, I'm going off, I'm doing this, doing that. And I realized that people say that was back in the past. It's not the past, the present. It's even now to the future. And it's hard. It's hard for a lot of them and us, you know, and it's hard for me because every time you just have a flashback of it, of how detrimental it is in life and history and people to understand.
And in the book, you really explain how that led you to become such an advocate for mental health awareness and the mental health of active duty members of the military and veterans who may be suffering from PTSD, wounded warriors. Talk about that work that you also do.
You know, I do 2,222 push-ups a day, except for Saturday and Sunday, and I do that because of 22 vets commit suicide a day. But I caveat not only with that, but also with Tears, which is my nonprofit. They're a big part of who I am and what I am and why. Suicide is the number two reason in the U.S. for death. You know, of ages 10 to 34 is number 10 on the charts for the U.S. for death. And that's unacceptable. And even right now, you think about U.S. military members, you think about us being trained in the services. Now you think about their families, their wives or husbands, their kids, you know, that get the aftermath from that. And it's more important that we all have to do our jobs. And I have to remind people that all the time, because the truth of the matter is that we're role models, no matter who you are. And instead of leading by influence of trying to monetary gain, lead of influence by caring and understanding and supporting people. I know today's viewers, they look at things that's going to be drama, but the truth of the matter is that drama creates more drama. You know, so if that's how you want to live your life, that's what you're going to answer for. But for me, I just want to do it where everybody can understand and grow from each other and get that word out to help and support each other.
Let's talk about your time at the White House. The first day you show up and start working there, what was that like? That must have been surreal.
You know, I say to people, the first day I went there, I'll be honest with you, I didn't look left or right. I just walked in and I worked. I said, what's my job? In the back of my mind, from past experiences, my mindset was somebody wanted me to fail. Someone didn't want me here. Someone wants to get rid of me. So I need to work as hard as possible and diligent as possible and as long as possible and just do my job. And whatever happens, happens. You know, And luckily for me, that was rewarded. And to this very day, I still work as hard. It took a long time for me to stop and think, oh man, wow, this is the White House. This is what's going on. This is history. This is something that no one else could ever experience or discover what it's like to be. And to me, that's humble. That's humble.
Now, do you, when you're the White House chef, do you have interactions with the different presidents that you served under? I think all of us imagine, you know, president making his way down to the kitchen late at night. There you are, and you serve him up something. How does it happen in real life?
Actually, that does happen that way. It is kind of, think of it like your mom or your grandma's kitchen where everybody comes to it, you know, whether they need to come in there or not, just because they want to come in the kitchen.
Sure.
But there is a lot of interaction. There is a lot of correspondence. And there is a lot of pass-through. So that's nothing new. But like I said, again, it's a job. You know, whether they're speaking to you or talking to you or not speaking to you, you always keep your professionalism, always keep your tact, and you also stand to the mission at hand. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm not a starstruck person, you know, so I teach them how to jump in and jump out, because if they say hello, it's not for you to be like, oh, hello, how you doing today? I'm so great.
Right.
So, things like that. It's a busy place in a busy world, and they have an extremely busy and tough job.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by former White House chef Andre Rush, who's got a new memoir out, Call Me Chef, Damn It, A Veteran's Journey from the Rural South to the White House. Now, you're a guy who's really in shape. You've got your famous 24-inch biceps. You're doing 2,222 daily push-ups. When you're there and you're with these different presidents and you see the shape they're in and what they're looking to eat, do you ever have the urge to say, Mr. President, I got a little bit of advice for you?
You know, believe it or not, a few of them have asked me that question, asked me some help. What would you eat? They'll look and they'll see, like, you're eating something, right? You know, so, you know, I say to people and I tell them that, you know, you got to think about the president. His perspective is that he and they are eating all over the world for different countries, different, you know, places, you know, different demographics, and a lot of the stuff has creams and butters and all these different things, and it can be heavy and weighing, and that's your ticker. That's your body. You only have one of them. So a lot are very tentative of what they eat and how, you know, just because it's the comfort of their own homes, and they can't do that 24/7. So but sometimes I do a little nudge and or, you know, flex a little bit, and they kind of get the hint.
And final question for you. You know, we live in such divisive times, and you served under Democrats and Republicans. Is there something, a type of food that you saw in your time as White House chef that crossed party lines that all the presidents seemed to really enjoy at one point?
You know, I tell people food is universal. You know, it's a love for it. It's that comfort. It's that, you know, holistic medication that I say in a joke that, you know, food can end wars and start wars. You know, that is Democrats and Republicans. So when you get that crossover with food, you know, it's all about how you prepare it and all about the love that you put inside a simple dish, whether it be that beef or that chicken or even that salad and how you present it. And regardless, everyone just falls in love with the anything that you'll do that you put your love and the spirit into it.
I thought maybe it was going to be a dessert. I thought maybe it was like a sliced apple pie or a little bit of ice cream or something like that.
You know, I love desserts. I ain't going to lie to you. Dessert, any dessert that I do, it's going to kill it. People that, oh, no, I shouldn't eat that. I shouldn't eat that. But then once they take a look at, like,
yeah,
what's that made out of?
Chef Andre Rush, former White House chef, with the new memoir out, Call Me Chef, Damn It, A Veteran's Journey from the Rural South to the White House, a fascinating read. Chef Rush, thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to all of our guests and, of course, to all of you for listening. If you want to hear previous episodes of this show, we're on your iHeartRadio app. Just search for iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.